Contributors to Wisconsin Public Radio include J.W. Jung Seed Company, Wallersheim Winery, and Rockweiler Insulation. You, too, can help ensure the future of WPR with your business sponsorship. Find out more at WPR.org/sponsor.
Take Wisconsin Public Radio on the go wherever you go. Listen to our live broadcasts, our archived programs, and the latest from WPR News. Go to WPR.org/mobile app to download.
If someone invited you to dinner to talk about death, you might hesitate before accepting. Death doesn't seem like the cheeriest subject for dinner table conversation. I'm Anne Strainchamps, and my guests this hour believe that we desperately need to have more and better conversations about death. They're part of a growing grassroots movement of death dinners and death cafes, where people come together to share a good meal and a bottle of wine while talking about a subject that used to be taboo. Our first guest is Michael Hebb. He's a Seattle-based artist, activist, and former restaurateur. He recently founded the National Death Over Dinner campaign, which is backed by some big names, the healthcare conference TED Med, spiritual leader Ram Dass, and others. We also want to know this hour what kind of conversations about death you think we should be having. What's the best conversation you ever had about death? We'll welcome your calls at 800-642-1234. And let's welcome Michael Hebb to the program. Michael, thanks for joining us today.
Honored to be here.
Yeah. So tell us about your project, Let's Have Dinner and Talk About Death. What got you started thinking about combining dinner and death?
Well, I've been focused on bringing people together around the table to discuss critical issues for almost 20 years. And it occurred to me that it would be remarkable to create an internet platform that not only just got the people that I could gather at a table, but inspired, thousands and potentially tens and hundreds of thousands of people to have their own dinner parties around important topics, and so that's what we were on the search for an issue that could really bring people together.
And then, was there any particular inspiration that led you to think about combining dinner parties and death?
Yeah, I mean, of course, in America, we think that the dinner table should be for polite conversation, or we're told that. In practice, I think that's not necessarily the case. I've seen the table hold many remarkable and difficult and challenging conversations quite well. People tend to be relaxed and at their best at a table, in a civil setting. And when we were looking for what topic could really bring together a large percentage of the population, I happened to be on a train ride in between Portland and Seattle in the Northwest, and I started a conversation with two physicians that I didn't know. We were all strangers, and they threw a couple statistics about our healthcare system at me that stopped me in my tracks. And the first one was that 70% of Americans want to die at home, and only 25% of us do.
Oh, that's sobering.
Yeah, it's half of America, and that just stopped me right there. And then the other statistic that fit on top of that and made it very clear the direction we needed to take was that end of life expense is the number one cause of personal bankruptcy, and obviously the most expensive part of our healthcare system that in itself is having such difficulty. So the fact that half of America is not getting what it wants and paying dearly for it personally and institutionally made it really clear that we need to have this discussion.
So you had this idea of, well, what if I organized a series of dinners where people come together and simply talk about death? Let's go kind of a little deeper into the experience. What's it like to, tell me about the first dinner over death you held.
Well, the first one was actually at a healthcare conference or a group that was at a healthcare conference, Health 2.0 in San Francisco. And we didn't start small. It was some of the most important leaders in healthcare and people that really you would think might be a bit guarded at the table because they have a lot on the line and they're with other peers, people that run major insurance companies and people that are writers in the space, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And what we immediately found is these very simple questions of asking people how they imagine their final days and who they'd want around them and what they would like that experience to be like, cracked right through any of that self-importance or that guardedness, even with that group. And there was laughter, there was tears, and then there was a deep engagement and camaraderie. So even at that level, it made me very clear that dear friends and family members and pretty much anybody can have this conversation to great effect.
Well, that's really interesting because you started out talking about, a couple of statistics and about issues of money and healthcare decisions, but it sounds like the kind of conversation that you wanted to facilitate is something much, much more intimate.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is such a big issue. We're not forwarding any kind of, agenda with this. It's really an open invitation for people to consider end of life in the way that they want to consider it with the people that they want to have the conversation with. You could be having it for philosophical reasons. You could be having it because you think you'd see those statistics and you want to plan for your own family or for yourself. You could be having it for spiritual reasons or because it just interests you. I think we wanted more than anything is to create the invitation and then to give people enough of enough structure and they felt safe and kind of held in the ability to have this experience powerfully.
Mm. So tell me how this works, because by now you've created a website with a kind of template so that people can decide to hold their own death dinners, and people have started doing that all over the country. So how do you word the invitation?
Yeah, it's tricky. So that's where you mentioned in the beginning that we have some really remarkable advisors and people involved in the project. And that was one of the first things I did was to talk to the smartest people in the space, all the way from artists to doctors to, people that have long history in holding this conversation and really just testing the questions and the type of conversations with them so that we could advise people how to have this conversation and give them suggestions. And the way that the website works right now, and I would like to say this, this is the beginning of the project. We have a large feedback loop with people that are using Let's Have Dinner and Talk About Death, and we hope to keep improving it. But it asks you who's coming to the table and how you best define yourself. Are you terminally ill, or is someone close to you terminally ill? Did someone that you care deeply about just pass, or are you just interested and curious? So as you make those selections on the website, it dynamically generates conversational prompts and actually homework for you so that people can have a shared experience before
homework.
They break bread.
What kind of homework?
So for each dinner, people are asked to select a short piece to read, watch, and listen based upon their intention and who's coming to the table, and then to share that with their guests. So it can be, a New Yorker article or a TED Talk or an NPR piece or a poem. There's a library that has been generated by our group that I think really is beautiful and provocative and thoughtful pieces on end of life, so that when you do, crack that first bottle of wine or sit down and look at each other across the table and be like, okay, we're going to start this conversation, you actually have a shared experience. You've all read or watched and listened to something together.
Hmm. Have you come up with any particular, any kind of rituals, something to kind of, I'm thinking this could be a conversation that would feel a bit sacred. You might want to set it apart a bit from an ordinary, everyday, mundane conversation.
Yeah. We make some suggestions about taking it seriously and, providing a home-cooked meal and lighting some candles and making it a special occasion. But I don't want the barrier of entry to be such that people are intimidated. I'm happy if people are having this conversation, as part of a picnic or in a restaurant, wherever it is they happen to have dinner. But the as far as, you know, one element that we've made part of every dinner is the first conversational prompt, and that's to bring to the table somebody who has passed, an ancestor or somebody recently who's meant a lot to you and why you admire them, so that the room is immediately filled with admiration and gratitude and respect for our ancestors. And I think that that creates a powerful envelope for the conversation.
Hmm. Michael, what do people wind up talking about? I mean, tell me about, I don't know, what are some conversations that have just really stayed with you from your experiences of death over dinner?
Gosh, I mean, I think it goes all over the map, which is, you know, great. There's levity, there's gravity, there's all kinds of the anecdotes. One of the anecdotes that I found so you know, interesting and memorable was one of our students, because we taught this as part of a course at University of Washington, and the students actually designed the platform with us. And one of the students remembered that their grandfather had had proposed to their grandmother over the dinner table, and how each night for 40 nights he had brought a single pearl and rolled it across the table to her, kind of with a mischievous smile at the end of 40 nights, and she had a full necklace. He then proposed marriage. And so those are priceless stories that I otherwise wouldn't have connected to around this student. So I think you're going to get a wealth of humanity, and you're going to get to know the people, you know, even your spouse or your children or your parents. You're going to get to know them better through this experience.
Mm-hmm. You know, it sounds like this is a movement that's really catching on. I mean, one reason, of course, is we've got an aging population. We boomers are getting older. I'm wondering, do you think, you know how when you have young kids or teenagers, you're supposed to sit them down for the sex talk, and then these days, of course, you sit them down for the drugs talk. Sounds like, sure. You know, it's time for adults to, older adults, to sit down with their adult children and have the death talk.
I think so. I mean, I think it's time for us to have all kinds of talks. I think that when you look at the statistic that, you know, 20% of American meals are eaten in a car, Michael Pollan quoted that in a recent book, it makes you pause and realize the depth of engagement in this culture around eating is just not what it could be. So I'm thrilled that people are gravitating to this topic. I think there's a cultural myth that people are afraid of talking about death. I absolutely would agree that people may be afraid of death, but I don't think that people are actually afraid of the conversation about it. And we've seen this immediate response where people are gravitating to the project. So that gives me it's inspiring, because it's very fulfilling, and we love watching that's what's happening so quickly.
We're talking with Michael Hebb. He's a Seattle-based artist, activist, and former restaurateur. He recently founded the National Death Over Dinner campaign. You can find out more about it at deathoverdinner.org, or check our Facebook page for links. Search for 45 North at WPR. I'm Ann Strainchamps, welcoming you to join our conversation. What kinds of conversations do you think we should be having about death? What's the most meaningful conversation you've ever had about death? You can join our conversation at 800-642-1234 or email us. The address is talk@WPR. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll welcome Wisconsin performance artist and UW-Madison art historian Jill Cassid. We're going to hear about her recent performance piece, Café La Petite Mort. This is 45 North on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up at 9 tonight, it's the Moth Radio Hour. This week, Voodoo and Therapy. A high school student in Nebraska tries to bluff his way through a French assignment, and a voodoo priestess tries to help the New Orleans Saints get to the Super Bowl. True stories told live on stage. I'm Ann Strainchamps, and we're talking about how to have more and better conversations about death. Michael Hebb is with us. He's the founder of the National Death Over Dinner Movement. And here in Wisconsin, UW-Madison art historian and performance artist Jill Cassid has a new performance piece she's been doing. It's called Café La Petite Mort, or Little Death Café. Jill, welcome. Hi, Jill. Are you on the air? Well, I'm not sure we've got Jill. We'll see what we can do to get her back. But in the meantime, Michael, the Death Dinner Movement is latest in a series of dinner table events you've organized. You founded this group called One Pot, I think, which specializes in, I've read what you call the technology of the dinner table. What does that mean?
Well, you know, what, that statistic we were talking about earlier that, you know, people are eating a large number of their meals in cars is kind of the launch pad for what One Pot is. It's a reconsideration of the table. How do we create new and more powerful rituals around the table? And I do that with small groups all over the world that, you know, thought leaders that are trying to make major impact on you know, global issues. And then in this kind of larger setting with this project, Let's Have Dinner and Talk About Death. But there's been, we've brought musicians together to spark dialogue and politicians and artists pretty much across the gamut, just understanding what can happen at the table.
But why the table? I mean, you could just convene conversations in, I don't know, conference rooms or something, or or a circle of chairs. What is it about the dinner table?
Well, the dinner table in many ways is the same as the fire. It's what convenes us. We came together around a fire historically to cook food and to warm ourselves and to, you know, gain nutrients. And that's where, you know, language and prayer and song and poetry and all of these things came from that experience of convening around fire and the table. And so it has this long history, this long genealogy of being a very important part of our culture and a place where new ideas happen and where we understand ourselves. You think about, you know, in the Jewish tradition, the Seder. It is a meal that millions of people have every year, and it kind of reconfirms what it means to be part of the Jewish community. So there's been, and the symposium in the Greek tradition, and then just the family dinner. These are important institutions that have been forgotten in the era of, you know, iPhones and, and speedy
right,
cars.
Fast food, or are at least endangered. Anyway, I think we've got Jill Cassid back on the line, so let's check in with her now. Jill is a performance artist and art historian at the UW-Madison, and she's got a new performance piece, which she's doing right now in conjunction with the Wisconsin Triennial. It's a series of one-on-one conversations about death that take place in cafes, and you can join them. But let's hear her talk about them. Jill, good morning.
Good morning.
Hi, thanks so much for joining us. So tell us about your new performance piece, Café La Petite Mort.
Well, I was so fascinated by the conversation so far, particularly the prompt to begin one of these dinners by invoking a particular ancestor, a particular, or just someone one has lost who is deeply meaningful and summoning them in some way. This project really began for me with my 104-year-old Holocaust-surviving mathematician grandmother who made the decision to die even though she had no illness. In fact, she was not even taking any medications.
Wow.
And that was quite an experience to go through that was a completely life-changing one for me, in that when she started this, I wasn't sure how I felt about it. I certainly didn't want to lose her, and it was a very important attachment for me. And she looked me straight in the eye and said, "Jill Helene Cassid, with all of your education, you don't know how to value life." And
she said what?
"You don't know how to value life." And that's a pretty powerful accusation. especially the particular phrasing, right? This you with all your education, but all the way through the PhD, of course, and somehow not knowing how to value life. And in the moment, I said something somewhat sassy, which was, "But you're the one who wants to die." And I got a very pointed look back and realized I needed to do my homework, and went to an essay by Sigmund Freud, the psychoanalyst that I know was a favorite of hers. It's an essay for the Times on war and death, which includes the pretty penetrating challenge, which is to value life is to be able to risk death. And one can interpret it in many ways, but what I took from it was a sense that to be able to confront death is to also know how to live, is to understand how to value life. So these aren't the kinds of opposites that we may have taken them to be, certainly since the what gets called the Enlightenment period, which is also for many responsible for severing us from the body, from intimate experiences with death. And so I went back and said, "Okay, I'm not going to put a pillow over your head, but let's do this." And one of my very good friends, a performance artist, P.A. Scantz, asked me once, "So, you know, if you could go anywhere, what would be your ideal research sites, where would you most want to do your research?" And I said, "Well, at this point, I feel as though those places find me." It was, you know, her bedside that was one of the most important research sites of my life.
So,
project really came out of that experience and intimate one-on-one conversation that I think can really be altering. But I'm sorry, you wanted to ask me something, and I.
Right. No. Well, for one thing, I was just really struck by the story of your grandmother's 104-year-old woman. Was she asking you to help her die?
Well, the way to carry it out for her was to refuse food, which was not an easy thing to do since she was in a retirement community. That would, prompt a psychiatric evaluation, and eventually we were able to negotiate so that she could be in a hospice care center, but that was its own complexity because they're not set up for that, right? It's set up to provide palliative care for those who already have a mortal disease prognosis, not someone who's just old and wants to hasten the end while they still have their faculties.
Were you with her when she died?
I was, yes.
And how did that, do you think, change your own thinking or feeling about death? For instance, about thinking about your own someday death?
Well, I was with her through the whole process, but I suppose I would also want to say that one of the things I found really interesting about the conversation that you've been having so far is, the suggestion that perhaps in addition to the sex conversation with young adults, we should now have the death conversation. And the experience of AIDS, the experience of cancer, just life accidents. My father drowned in a pool when I was 16. Death intrudes, out of sequence. I think that one of the great myths is that we should somehow expect that death happens in ways that correspond with our notion of generation, or that we will. I suppose there have been many life experiences, but you asked me about being by her bedside, and I would say that among the many things that I learned is that, this is part of a new book project, is a very different sense of ethics, which I think really has to create some spacing between what it is that we might want. I would have loved to have been able to hold on to her forever, and it really seemed as though she would live forever, and some profound respect for our differences, including, for example, her clearly profound and very articulate, and also sound-minded decision that she wanted it to end, and to not also impose my own not just beliefs but needs.
Right. I want to get back to talking with Michael also, and I want to welcome our listeners as well. I'm curious to know what kind of conversations you think we should be having about death, or perhaps there's a story about a conversation about death that you've had that that was profound. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. We'll welcome your calls, or you can email us. The address is talk@wpr.org. Michael, are these the kinds of conversations that people have at the Let's Have Dinner and Talk About Death dinners?
Yeah. I mean, these are the beautiful stories that come up. I mean, I think that to stop and to pay attention to the challenge from your 104-year-old grandmother is extraordinary, because that's at the center of this project. People are like, oh, how morbid. You have this project about death and you want to talk about death all the time. It's like, I actually don't want to talk about death all the time. I want people to have the ability and the facility and the and some skill around it, because I want them to live better. And I want them to make better decisions when they're alive and with their days and their moments. And it's really a project about life. And I think that, you know, that's kind of how we go full circle with some of the questions and in the project, is to kind of remind people that this is about life. This isn't just about, the end.
Well, you know, the many religious traditions admonish us to keep our death close before us, to keep our death in mind. And I think we so often don't want to do that. You know, we just want to hold on to, you know, Jill, you said, that you sort of had this belief that maybe your grandmother really would just live forever. And I think, you know, secretly, we all think that about ourselves.
Well, and then I suppose what I found to be so powerful about the particular conversations over coffee that I've been doing as part of this one-on-one series of performances, Café La Petite Mort, which is a play on words, literally translated, right?
It's a Little Death Café.
Right, Little Death Café, a metaphor for orgasm, which is a way of saying that we don't really know what death is, but we do have certain experiences of certain kinds of loss of control in life, and some of those are profoundly pleasurable. That the sort of shiver of what one might call death, and perhaps not in any way inaccurately, that sense of losing oneself can be extremely important. And that what can happen, I think, in these very intimate conversations is that death becomes a medium, or talk about death becomes a medium for creating important bonds. And some of those across generations, across differences.
Yeah, that's the most powerful thing we all have in common, aside from the fact that we were all born.
Mm-hmm.
I want to go next to, we've got a phone call. Lena's on the line from Milwaukee. Hi, Lena.
Hi.
Did you have a story to share?
Yes, I do. A few years ago, my dad had contracted bone cancer, and I was fortunate enough to spend 6 weeks with him in the hospital as he was making his transition. And during that time, it was so nice to be able to talk about childhood things, and I was a terrible teenager, and to resolve so many of those things. But one of the things that I shared with my dad was, when I was 17, I had a near-death experience that was very profound. And I shared that with him, and he was an engineer, a PhD engineer. So he's very logical and rational, but also a very spiritual man as well. And I talked to him at great length about my experience. And
was he inclined to believe it?
He did. He did. I mean, I explained to him, I saw his mother, and she spoke to me in Italian, and it was just beautiful. And to see him go from being very frightened to being able to release because he truly felt there was something else on, quote unquote, the other side.
Were you with him when he died?
I actually had stepped out of the room for about 20 seconds when he took his last breath. But I was right back in there. He was surrounded by all my siblings and their spouses and my mother. And it's just a very, very peaceful transition.
Thank you. Thank you so much for calling to share that story. You can join the conversation, too, if you have a story you would like to share with us. What is the most meaningful conversation or experience you've had with death? The number is 800-642-1234. Jill, I'm so struck by what you said about death being letting go of the self, and that in other situations and circumstances, we sort of enjoy or look for ways to feel that just for a flash, for a second, we've left the self behind. Michael, do people talk at the death over dinner? Do they talk at that level about death, or is it, I don't know, a little more practical?
No, I think the dinners that I've been involved with, and this is, you know, kind of the thing about the project, is it's, I'm not moderating the grand majority of these conversations, which is great. It's completely, it's not just participatory. It's run by individuals themselves. But, you know, I've been at dozens, and absolutely the conversations run the philosophic to the practical gamut. And there's a lot of freedom to let the conversation go the way it needs to go. You find that the thing that I think is really interesting about these dinners and this particular conversation is people tend to be, they listen incredibly well. They respect each other's stories and views because everybody is an expert and nobody's an expert.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a big question mark at the end of the sentence. Everybody has equal space to talk and share and experience. So I think that that's just an activity where people are actually listening to each other and putting their phones down, and that there's some sort of not enforced but just natural reason to do that is really meaningful.
Mm. I want to go to one more call. We've got Barb on the line from Cedarburg. Hi, Barb.
Hi, I just had to call after your comment about us all dying. I'm a hospice nurse, and I just have to say, yes, we do all eventually pass on, but the most interesting part of my profession is seeing how different people die, or how differently people die. All people die differently, and it's just amazing to me. When families will say, well, when do you think my loved one will pass? I never can give an answer because I really don't know, for one. But secondly, I've seen patients last for months. I've seen patients last for hours. And I think it's really interesting to know that, you know, we live as hard as we can, we live great lives, and we all just die differently.
But there's something sort of beautiful about that, don't you think? I mean, Michael, you said one of the things you begin talking about at the death dinners is, how would you like to die yourself? Or trying to begin to think, imagine your own death. I think sometimes we think death is something that's going to be imposed on us rather than thinking it will be our own unique, special experience.
Yeah, there's this culture in this around, you know, YOLO, you only live once, in the in youth culture, and I think it's extended on up. But the, clearly... Well, we don't know if we only live once, but we also don't know if we only die once, but we can make that assumption. And this conversation around the good death, or an intentional or a thoughtful death, where we have some control in it. And obviously, hospice has done an extraordinary job at building that culture and giving that option to people. So I think that, you know, it's exciting to see that conversation is gaining some momentum.
Yeah. Jill, what do you do? We've talked a little bit about your performance piece. What is it you actually do?
Ah, well, it's so interesting, right? So the good death, euthanasia, that's how you would literally translate it, and yet that's a term that's so caught up not just in practicalities but legal constraints. And so to come up with prompts that would unhook imagining and feeling towards something like the good death from advanced directives and the few states that have physician-assisted suicide or physician-assisted death, to also talk about sensation and what it might entail to face death, practice toward it with other kinds of feelings, including something like joy. So
people basically come and sit down and just have a one-on-one conversation with you.
Well, it's right. So it's somewhat structured in that I start off with a actually a negative question, which is based on a suggestion from Freud that it's sometimes the no or the not that allows something else to emerge. So I ask people, what's the death that they don't want? And then we move to how would you imagine what the good death for you might entail.
We're going to wind up leaving it there because we're running out of time, but it's been a pleasure talking with both of you. Michael Hebb is the founder of deathoverdinner.org. You can find lots more information on our website at wpr.org/45north. Jill Cassett is a performance artist and art historian at the UW-Madison. You can schedule a personal one-on-one performance with her through the Café Allongé project. And again, there's a link on our website, wpr.org/45north. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll explore the story of the real Count Dracula, the man behind the myth. I'm Anne Strange-Hemps, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Anne Strange-Hemps, and this is 45 North on Wisconsin Public Radio. Everyone knows the story of Dracula, the vampire count.
I am Dracula.
Or do we? Behind the legend of the fictional Count Dracula, there was once a real man. And writer Victor Foya spent 40 years researching him. He's just published a first volume in what's to be a 7-volume historical novel called The Dracula Chronicles. Now, Victor grew up in Transylvania himself, and he defected as a young man and came to the U.S. He recently retired to Door County after a successful career as a corporate executive. Victor, welcome. And what did you learn about or know about Count Dracula when you were growing up in Transylvania?
My first encounter with him, my physical encounter, if you will, is from about the age of 6 when we had our first school outing, and we were taken to his birth town to see the house he was born in that still stands today. And, of course, we were lectured on his importance to the country. He was a national hero who saved the country from being taken over by the Ottoman Empire, age of 6, when we had our first school outing, almost preschool outing. And we were taken to his birth town to see the house he was born in that still stands today. And, of course, we were lectured on his importance to the country. He was a national hero. And that's all I knew until I got to Chicago. So he was the king, not a count. He's the one who saved the country from being taken over by the Ottoman Empire.
You're talking about real history. And to most people, you know, you say the name Dracula and everybody assumes we're talking about a fictional character created by Bram Stoker and celebrated in the movies. You're talking about somebody different.
This is what happened to me. I did not know about that fictional vampire character until at the age of 22, I managed to defect from the communist country. And after about 8 months in refugee camps in Italy, I was sent to Chicago. And I happened to be downtown just taking in the sights. And I see on the marquee the word Dracula. And I was shocked because I said, Dracula, that's such a rare name. How would that be known in this country since Romania is such a small country there? People wouldn't know about their national heroes. Mm-hmm. And then I asked around, I said, well, of course, everybody knows Dracula. He's a count and a vampire and all these things. And I said, oh, boy, this has to be set straight one day because it really isn't what I was taught about him.
I want to back up for a minute and just make a quick detour because your own personal story is so fascinating and you just alluded to it very quickly. But so growing up in Romania at the time, that was the height of the Cold War and you were growing up in behind the Iron Curtain.
It was the height of the Cold War and it was a world of complete restriction and lack of rights. We didn't even know that humans had to have rights. I mean, we were happy to be able to stay out of trouble by following the party line. The earliest memory I have, at the age of 10, I was telling my friends that when I grow up, I will run away, which was a very stupid thing to say and very dangerous, but I didn't know.
Was it dangerous to defect?
It could have been very dangerous, for some more than others. In my case, I had to choose whether to finish university or drop out and be free, and I dropped out. Mm. And the risks that I took was basically I could have been at any given time, as I did get on the official government-approved tour of Italy for 5 days. But to get there, I had to bribe a party official. And then I did the stupid things that most people do, such as hit some money in my shoes. And that would have resulted between, 5 to 10 years of hard labor. So I took some risk. Other people took bigger risk because they crossed the border on land and the border was mined and they could have been blown up. I didn't have that much of a risk.
Now, so, you said after you defected, you wound up in a refugee camp?
Yeah, well, that's what happens, yes. Once you defect, you have to go somewhere. Mm-hmm. You can't just exist like that. So I surrendered to the authorities in Italy, asked for political asylum, and just because I had a distant acquaintance in Chicago, they asked, where do you want to go? I said, Chicago. So I landed in Chicago, and I started everything from there again.
Wow, and you said when you landed, you pretty much had just your clothes and a toothbrush.
I had saved about $12 by doing some odd jobs. But the worst thing of all is the language, obviously.
Yeah, you didn't speak English.
I landed in Chicago, and I couldn't say a word. So I started walking up and down the streets, actually the Lakeshore Drive, knocking on the building doors, and I had a little phrase written down saying, I want to work. And, of course, they slapped the door in my face several times, and then I kept doing the same circuit over and over. And about the fourth day, they got tired of me, and somebody hired me.
Well, I love the story because it's such a classic, rags-to-riches story in a way. I mean, you wound up a CEO of an international corporation, but as you said, all the time intending someday to get back to your roots, in this case, your roots being Dracula. Was Dracula even really his name?
Dracula is a nickname. His father is responsible for the name Dracula indirectly because he grew up in Germany at the court of Emperor Sigismund, and he was inducted into Sigismund's Order of the Dragon. To the Romanians, Drache was Dracul, and coincidentally, Dracul means both the dragon and the devil, which gave very, very dark connotation to this name. He also acquired another nickname, was given to him by the Turks, as the Impaler.
Yes, I was going to ask you. I mean, I've heard of him. Lots of people have heard
Turkish,
of Vlad the Impaler.
In Turkish, they call him Kazıklı, which meant the Impaler. And he was so fierce that mothers used to scare their little children. If they didn't behave, then Kazıklı would come and get him, the Impaler.
But he has the history is full of terrifying tales of his atrocities. And supposedly he would impale 20,000 people at a time.
Well, that is a subject that I have to deal with because everybody thinks they know Dracula from those accounts. Since the accounts were written by his victims, more or less, and by his enemies, they have to be exaggerated. So I have to look at other sources to derive a more accurate picture of his doings. I'm not going to present him as a nicer person, so to speak, but I believe I will convince my readers, A, that he did not do it as a pastime, that he did not feast under those stakes while people were suffering, but that he did what it needed to be done in order to save his country. Mm.
So what made him so notable in his time?
Well, one of the most important things that is not known to the readers, and it was not presented by his detractors, is the fact that he attacked the Ottoman Empire instead of waiting to be attacked. He attacked them, provoked them to come after him before they were ready. And when they came, he defeated them. And their sultan at that time, Mehmed II, looked like he was unstoppable. He had just conquered Constantinople, and his program was to go to Rome. Dracula stopped him there, and Mehmed never recovered from that. He never really could amount to that, and he died kind of an old and bitter man because of that. So you could say indirectly he saved Europe, but I don't want to go that far because the events are too complex to ascribe such a major feat to a single individual. But he did do something at the time against the most formidable sultan that ever existed. He stopped him, he beat him, and sent him back home.
How much is actually known about Vlad Dracula?
There are facts. There are letters written by him. So, for example, he, in his own words, said, I have killed 23,000-some Turks. This is when he attacked the Turks in the winter, crossing the Danube, the frozen river. And to prove it, he's writing this to a would-be ally, the king of Hungary. He says, to prove this, I'm sending you here 23,000 noses. And he had they had this caravan of noses and ears that he sent, just in case you doubt that I did this. So I take what is known of his life and then try to imagine what kind of a person would have done the things that we know he's done. For example, what person would choose to attack the most powerful empire with an army that was puny and without any allies? What does it take to do that? I would have run away from there. I would have taken my bags of gold and gone to Hungary or Paris or something. He said, no, I'm going to make my stand here because the freedom of this country is what I'm after. So
where did the stories about his being a vampire come from? Did Bram Stoker just make that up?
I think that during his lifetime, blood behavior was so aberrant in some ways and so inexplicable, I should say, to his contemporaries that even at that time, rumors started to surface. For example, he was rumored at one point that he was a shapeshifter because somebody saw a wolf coming out of a cave where he had gone in. So you couple this extreme behavior of his with fearlessness in war, inability to be killed. All attempts to assassinate him had failed. And then you start thinking, well, he's not one of us. He's special. He's something else. I think the kernels of those legends were born in his lifetime.
So of all the places that you must have visited, places connected with him, are there one or two that just for you were especially evocative, where you felt you could, I don't know, feel a little bit of his presence?
The most interesting place I visited, I believe, is Mount Athos in Greece. It's a peninsula that's accessible only by water, and it's also accessible only to male visitors. Females have been banned from there for 1,000 years. And so I had to apply. It took me about 6 months to get approval to go there. You can only stay 3 nights. But you stay for free. They put you up in the monastery with the monks, and you eat their fare and take the cold showers if they have that running water. And in doing this, one of the three monasteries that I actually chose at random happened to be a monastery that Vlad Dracula saved from bankruptcy. And it's rumored that he even stayed in that monastery. So you can imagine how I felt to be in the same place where he might have been 500 years ago.
I'm curious about having embarked on this long project. You know, you've written the first volume of what's to be seven volume history. In the meantime, the Dracula legend, you know, the fictional vampires continue to take off in this country. You know, there are more and more movies about them. What is it, do you think, about that fictional vampire, dashing vampire, that continues to appeal?
Well, a lot of books about the real Dracula are coming out as well now, and movies. And then there is the hybrid. It's almost like the Prius of Dracula. He is a half vampire, half real person. You know, there is a yearning in people for phenomenon like this where you marry these dashy characters with some dark side. It's Jekyll and Hyde, right? So perhaps it's a fortuitous meeting of this man's life story and extreme deeds with that yearning that we have as a society for something that's not that simple, not that straightforward, but rather complex and dark and evil. And he's fulfilling that requirement so well that 500 years later we are still here talking about him, and we'll probably never stop doing so.
Victor, thank you so much for giving him back to us.
Thank you for having me on your show. Anne.
Thanks. Victor Foya recently retired from a career as a corporate executive. He lives in Door County and has just published Volume 1 of the Dracula Chronicles. More information on our website and posted on our Facebook page, which is also a good place to keep track of what we're doing. You can find us at 45 North on WPR. Be sure to friend us while you're there. Thanks to our producers, Marika Suval and Rhonda Fanning, and to audio engineers Dave Potras and Joe Hartke. I'm Ann Strainchamps. Have a great weekend. We'll talk again next Friday here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.